single drop of pond water, magnified many times. It's filled with an amazing variety of intricate microscopic organisms, each possessing its own unique characteristics and abilities. These tiny creatures are supposedly living representatives of the first primitive life forms that evolved on Earth. They're called simple, one-celled protozoa. But are they really so simple? Could they have evolved by blind chance? Are they really our ancestors? Where did life come from? Was it spontaneous generation, or was it special creation? Man has always been fascinated and intrigued from the very earliest recorded beginnings of history about where he, man, came from. And the speculations about how it all happened, how we got here, where all life forms came from, are sometimes hilariously funny. Now today, in our modern era of the space age and scientific development and the explosion of knowledge that is such a fantastic rate that even scientists in special fields cannot keep a pace with any one single specialized field, we seem to feel we have arrived, that now science really has all the answers about the origin of life. We're going to see in this program and others to follow that those answers are not answers but giant questions, that no answers are really available unless you look squarely at the one unaskable question: could there be a God? Could there have been a divine, all-wise creator being who organized and created from nothing all that is? That's almost an unaskable question. It is almost impossible for most people to contemplate. And yet, as I'm going to show you, you are asked by science to contemplate equally unaskable or unthinkable ideas about the origin of life, because even science claims that life came into existence from not living, and that matter came into existence from virtually nothing. Well, the ancients had ideas about as funny as some of their names, the ideas about spontaneous generation. For example, Aristotle, in his ignorance, thought worms, larvae of bees, ticks, and other insects came from morning dew, decaying slime and manure, dry wood, hair, and sweat, or maybe meat. He had all kinds of funny ideas. A fellow named Empedocles, he agreed that life came from these, but that they needed the, and I'll quote his words, don't ask me to explain it, the fructifying influence of rain saturated with air and of the sun's heat to make it happen. Then there was a fellow named Anaximander, who felt life arose in sea ooze, a very, very sticky suggestion. Thales believed it came from the water. Others felt life has always existed. These ideas continued for years. Van Helmont, for example, in the 15th century, devised a method for manufacturing mice. And he said all you had to do was to put wheat, soiled linen, and cheese in an attic or a stable, and presto, change-o, mice would appear. Now, one of the typical 17th century views is rather remarkable, too, when one astute person said, and this is quoted in the Britannica, can one doubt whether in cheese or in timber worms are generated, or in beetles and wasps, in cow dung, or if butterflies, locusts, shellfish, snails, eels, and such life can be procreated of putrefied matter? To question this, he said, is to question reason, sense, and experience. If he doubts this, let him go to Egypt, and there he will find the fields swarming with mice begot of the mud of the Nile, to the great calamity of the inhabitants. And that was science. And of course, always science said, if you don't look at it our way, and if you doubt what we say, you are therefore doubting sense, reason, and experience. Experiments of Redi and Pasteur disproved the theory of spontaneous generation, and yet, but only in a different form, many people still believe that idea now. Redi performed a controlled experiment. In both bowls, he placed a similar chunk of meat. The only difference in the treatment appears to be that he covered one bowl loosely with a cloth because he believed that something other than spontaneous generation might be taking place. The experiment confirmed his hypothesis because he found that the maggots appeared in the bowl which had been left uncovered, but not in the covered bowl. The meat in the covered bowl began to decay because bacteria undoubtedly entered, but it showed no maggots forming. His reasoning led to the life cycle of the fly, which is known so well today, or at least to the understanding of it. Flies lay eggs, the eggs hatch into the larva, which are maggots burrowing into the meat. The larva eventually produce the flies. He brought this to the attention of the world, and as a result, the doctrine of spontaneous generation died a slow but nonetheless effective death in relationship, at least to the origin of larger creatures you can see with the naked eye. But the amazing thing is that that theory, as absurd as it may have sounded back in the 16th and 17th century, is still one of the most propounded, the oft discussed, and the oft reviewed in books on the origin of life, on biology and microbiology and the like, about evolutionary thought today. The only difference is that instead of being flies or creatures you can see, they now speculate about the origin of microscopic and unseen life. It's the same theory, but just a difference in dimension. So the doctrine was held to be valid for small organisms. It had found a safe resting place for many years, though it was believed that big creatures, such as flies or frogs, could not spontaneously generate. Pasteur disproved spontaneous generation, though, for microscopic organisms as well. First, he heated and sterilized bacterial culture broth in two flasks. One of the flasks was corked and the other left open. The open flask, exposed to the air and bacteria, became cloudy due to prodigious numbers of bacteria. The sealed flask remained clear. But, some said, the bacterial life couldn't spontaneously form because it didn't have access to air. To show this explanation was not correct, Pasteur used curved-necked flasks and showed that even if left open to the air, no bacteria would grow in the culture, provided a long neck was used to prevent dust containing bacteria from entering the culture broth. So the theory that life has always existed was another desperate attempt by evolutionists to explain creation in all of its magnificence, its interdependability, and its intricacy, and its harmony, its origins of the laws that we see working upon us today. The fact of all life reproducing life after its own kind. Some of this had to be explained away. It all had to be explained away if they were to deny the laws of a lawgiver God and the way he tells us to live. So in order to do away with repressive laws that they thought interfered with their own personal appetites and the way they wanted to live life, this by admission, by the way, of some leading evolutionists still alive today, they had to explain creation without a creator. And one idea was, and largely discredited though, that of Wilhelm Preyer. And his idea was that life has always existed, but just in different forms. But Earth began, according to some scientists, as a fiery ball. But how could life exist then? Preyer claims that life is only part of one big organism, which includes inorganic material such as fire. But there's a big difference between life and non-life. Few people really accept Preyer or Preyer's theory today. Then there's the cosmoa theory, or cosmozoa, rather, theory, or panspermia, it's called. This theory states life existed forever and came to Earth when meteors struck. Now, scientists are outraged when you say, yes, but God existed forever. But they turn around and say, yes, but life existed forever. But why didn't the germs burn up when passing through the atmosphere? How did they survive radiation, extreme temperatures, and absolute dryness in the vacuum of outer space? Variations of this idea that spores traveled by light rays or by dust particles, but the same problems would hold true even in those variations of the origin of life as they would for germs coming into the earth on meteors. Then there was the idea of abiogenesis, and that is another name for spontaneous generation, or abiogenesis, however they may pronounce that. Most scientists reject cosmozoic theory, but believe rather in chemical evolution, or abiogenesis, another form of spontaneous generation. Scientists think instead of non-life changing into complex animals, it later evolved in a more complex life. But this is still a form of belief in spontaneous generation because of their ideas about the amino acid soups, which we'll discuss now. Some say different conditions from those on the present Earth made it possible for this type of spontaneous generation of microscopic organisms, or at least those constituents of cells which make up cellular life or molecular life today. Many different hypotheses are included under this theory. Here are some of them. The first is the thin soup theory, that organic chemicals in a thin soup of hydrocyanic acid, one of the deadliest of all poisons, combined to form the first living organisms. And then there was the polka-dotted air bubbles theory. That's the idea that organic substances necessary for life formed on polka-dotted air bubbles in the sea. Supposedly, the bubbles attracted dissolved chemicals that combined to form life. Then there's the brown scum theory. It could have been green or blue, but this particular scientist chose brown. Life formed from concentrated chemicals, he said, a kind of amino acid scum in a hot pool where water had evaporated. You could call it the from scum we have come theory. Then there was the intense cold theory, that maybe life had crystallized when amino acids and nucleic acids froze in some primitive mixture. And then there was the cracks in rocks theory. You could call this the cracked theory, if you would like, because this theory says that cracks in rocks sheltered primitive bits of life which evolved from various kinds of dust mixed with water that had become lodged in the cracks. You could almost take your pick and come up with an idea of your own, actually, because some of those are so far afield, and some of them, of course, so obviously self-contradictory. Some require heat, others extreme cold, some dryness, and some outer space, and some wetness, amino acidic soups, and so on, that the theories are endless. There are just about as many of them as there are scientists to propound them. Well, there's a popular belief. A lot of people will parrot back to you on the street if you interview them and ask them what do they think about science, about immortality, about life after death, about the origin of life. They will tell you with great confidence, I firmly believe that someday soon science is going to solve the aging theory, the aging problem. They're going to figure out how to keep us immortal and how to give us life eternal. And very soon now they're liable to create a living creature in a test tube. So there's a popular belief that there was once a mixture of methane, ammonia, hydrogen, and water in a warm sea which formed organic substances. Reasoning is that if these chemicals are together long enough, something might happen. Some improbable combinations might occur until some molecules might be formed. Then after this might come amino acids, proteins, DNA, viruses, cells, bacteria, algae, protozoa, metazoa, and so on. And finally, higher life forms. Scientists believe that after amino acids joined, or after they became, rather, more complex molecules joined together and formed molecules which could self-reproduce or self-replicate. But could inorganic chemicals do this? Many believe, though, that DNA, proteins, enzymes, and the like were formed, but all experiments tend to show that, with rare exceptions, such substances can only be produced in living organisms. A famous geologist, Mr. Stokes, who wrote the book Essentials of Earth's History, said, and I quote, "This leads us as to what may well be the most basic riddle of all. How, when no life existed, did substances appear that today are absolutely essential to living organisms or living systems, yet can only be formed by these systems? Indeed, the problem verges on the absurd," he admitted in his book on the Essentials of Earth's History. If you want to get some of it solved for yourself, you ought to write for these brochures, the one entitled The Origin of Life, that shows some of the almost impossible questions that must be answered by evolutionists who try to do away with the idea of a creation being actually brought into existence by a divine, all-wise creator. The second brochure is called Probability, and what it says about evolution. Given enough time, evolutionists say, almost anything could have happened. We'll discuss a little later on in this program the idea of chance or of probability, of randomness creating the order and the beauty that we see today. These two brochures, the one on the origin of life and probability, are absolutely free of charge if you will write to the address which you will see, and also you can call right now to the toll-free number we will give you, and again at the close of the program, and we'll have those two brochures on their way to you in the mail as soon as possible, the very same day we receive your request, and especially if you call to the toll-free number that you will see. The biggest factor against the hypothesis of dead chemicals combining to form life is the chance against their combining to form even what is called the simplest cell. And let's find out whether or not cells are really simple, because the cell, though looked upon as simple, is almost unbelievably complex. The advance of science has made the origin of life question not easier to imagine, but far more improbable and impossible to contemplate. as we have learned and as scientific knowledge has increased, the chances or the probability idea of there having been evolutionary creation or the gradual evolving of all lower life forms to the higher life forms has become increasingly difficult to contemplate. The study of the cell has, on the whole, tended to widen rather than to narrow the enormous gap that separates even the lowest forms of life from the inorganic world. That's a quote from a book called The Theory of Evolution. So let's take a look at what some people call simple life forms. Here you will see some representative protozoa under low magnification. Take the amoeba. It's often considered one of the less highly organized protozoa. Some even claim that evolution started with the amoeba, but let's see just how simple he really is. The amoeba moves around from one place to another simply by stretching out his cytoplasm in a process called streaming. His body becomes lengthened into what is termed a pseudopod, a kind of fake foot. Some protozoans move by means of whip-like flagella, and they're called flagellates. Some types of protozoans don't have a rigid cellular membrane, but a very flexible one, and this allows them to rapidly change their shape as they swim about. The paramecium moves by a beating action of many tiny hair-like organs called cilia. Now, actually, these are thousands of different protozoa that have been identified and studied and given names. Here we see a remarkable creature called the vorticella. An adverse stimulus causes this stalk to coil up like a spring and thus withdraw the animal toward the object toward which it is attached. Then there are the volvox colonies of cells. Some one-celled organisms do not separate after cell division and remain together, forming a colony. By means of this association, some of the cells specialize for reproduction. Then, within the larger colonies, daughter colonies are formed. Eventually, the large parent colony will burst and release the new colonies. These microscopically tiny creatures also have an incredible ability to seek out and devour food. Food elements are brought into the cell and are gathered into fluid droplets called food vacuoles, where digestion takes place. The euglena consumes food like many other microscopic animals, yet it's also like a plant because it has chlorophyll and makes food by photosynthesis. Fluid waste is discharged by the contractile vacuole, which has the ability to expel unwanted fluids from the cell's interior. Solid wastes are expelled directly to the exterior of the cell. Paramecia and other microscopic creatures have voracious appetites. In a single drop of pond water, literally hundreds of protozoa can be seen busily swimming about, ferreting out and devouring food. Some protozoa, like the amoeba, engulf their food by simply flowing around it. They literally surround the food particle and consume it. This microscopic animal has a mouth opening surrounded by few ciliary structures. The movements of these structures create currents which sweep food particles into his mouth. Sometimes one kind of protozoa may feed on another. Here, two suctorians are in the process of sucking body fluid from another protozoan. Suctorians have tentacles equipped with a kind of suction disc and have a fluid causing paralysis of other protozoa. Here's a closer view of suctorians where you can clearly see what happens to protozoa that come in contact with suctorians. Another example of one species eating another is this shot of a didenium eating a paramecium, the paramecium having eaten bacteria. The didenium has his work cut out trying to consume this meal. Actually, you have a whole food chain even with the microscopic animals, just as you have with the larger ones. Digestion is also a fascinating process in these tiny creatures. Sometimes a single paramecium will have both pink and red food vacuoles. The change to red color is an indication of digestive activity by the paramecium. It means that the animal has added acid for digestion. A paramecium with blue food vacuoles is an indication that the paramecium has secreted alkali into its vacuoles. Sometimes the paramecium has both red and blue vacuoles, implying that the change from acid to alkaline is just occurring. The reproduction of these protozoa is also a fantastic and really inexplicable ability. Reproduction is most commonly accomplished by a process called binary fission. Fission means splitting. The process is illustrated here as an adult animal begins to divide and continues until eventually the parts separate into two animals. There is no parent left to die of old age. For this reason, some like to say the protozoa possesses immortality. Now here we see another paramecium dividing. You can also say that this is an asexual form of reproduction, since the offspring are derived from only one parent by division of the parent's body. Under favorable conditions, paramecia will divide as many as four times a day. If all the paramecia so produced were to survive, it would take only a few days until the mass of paramecia would equal the mass of the Earth. Then there's the process of conjugation, where reproduction involves a sexual process in which the two animals exchange nuclear elements. But actual reproduction is still by binary fission. Here we see that conjugation process repeated, another incredible ability of these tiny cells. The point is, these so-called simple, primitive, one-celled creatures are actually amazingly complex and demonstrate in one tiny microscopic cell a whole range of abilities. Cells may vary from the size of an ostrich egg, or the yolk of one at least, to tiny bacteria, which are so small it would take 50,000 of them to measure only 1 inch. Most are microscopically small. The human body contains over 100 trillion cells of various types. The cell, then, is really such an astounding unit that it led one leading biologist to say, and I quote in his book, that it's such an astoundingly clever unit that when we think of it from the point of view of evolution, it seems easier to imagine a single cell evolving into complex animals and plants than it does to imagine a group of chemical substances evolving into a cell. Well, I can see why it would. Because cells are so complex, the idea that one could happen by chance or by accident is astronomically impossible. A.I. Oparin, who is called the father of chemical evolution, said in his book, The Origin of Life, and I quote, "It is highly improbable that such a complex apparatus as life, that is, could have arisen fortuitously. If we consider the probability that in the midst of inorganic matter, a large factory with smokestack, pipes, boilers, machines, ventilators, etc., suddenly sprang into existence by some natural process, let us say volcanic eruption, this would be taken at best for a silly joke," he said. "Yet, even the simplest microorganism has a more complex structure than any factory, and therefore its fortuitous creation is much less probable," end of quote. He nevertheless believed that the simplest living organisms graduated, or originally gradually, by a long evolutionary process came into being, that it was a long evolutionary process. In spite of this admission, he still believed in the process. But let's see if it is really reasonable to believe the order and design we see in living things and in the cells which comprise them simply is a result of chance. Remember the old argument about the monkey and the typewriter? I've mentioned it several times on the radio program and in previous telecasts. It goes something like this, that given a monkey and a typewriter and a stack of papers, anything is likely over a period of time. That in a given period of time, he's going to strike maybe two letters in sequence like at, of, or by, and to, and so on. And that by chance alone, finally a three-letter word, and then a four-letter, and a five-letter, and about a four-syllable, and finally whole chains of words, and given enough time, maybe books, and maybe the entirety of the Encyclopedia Britannica. Well, if something like this could happen, how much time is really needed? You can speculate by chance the monkey might type a two-letter word, but what about the whole encyclopedia? By chance alone, could that have happened? Could life form species arise by chance if given enough time? Could Darwin's book also have time to develop by blind chance? Given a chimpanzee, then, a typewriter and a stack of paper, how long would it take the chimp to peck out just the title of Darwin's controversial book, The Origin of Species? 18 letters and 3 spaces, a total of 21 strokes with a typewriter. It would take a few hundred attempts, you would think, or would it? Well, let's look. There are 44 keys in a typewriter, 26 letters, 9 digits, a space bar, numerous symbols and punctuation marks. What were the odds would be on the first word? One chance in 44 on the T, one in 44 on the H, one in 44 on the E, and so on. So you have to multiply 44 times 44 times 44, and the answer is one chance in 85,184. By blind chance alone, the chimp has only one chance in that many, 85,184, of getting these first three letters correct. But let him go on. One chance in 44 that he'll hit the space bar next, and then one chance in 44 of hitting the O, then the R, the I, the G, the I, and the N, and so on. The odds now become astronomical. For 44 times itself 10 times turns out to be about 27,720,000,000,000. Assuming the chimp started with a clean sheet of paper every time he made a mistake, how high a stack of paper would he use? On the average, 27,720,000,000,000 sheets would be wasted to achieve a two-word goal, the origin. And the stack of 27,720,000,000,000 wasted sheets, how high would that be? Well, 1,000 sheets of paper would be about 6 inches, 2 million sheets, 1,000 feet high, 10 million, about a mile high. But 27,720,000,000,000 sheets would reach out into the heavens, past the moon, all the 93,000,000 miles to the sun, and over 1,000,000,000 miles further for a total of 2,772,000,000 miles. How many tons of paper? Well, 8 pounds for 1,000 sheets, 4 tons for 1,000,000. So the chimp wasted 110,880,000,000 tons of writing paper, tens of thousands of times the U.S. production for a year. How much time? Well, 5 seconds a sheet allows 12 sheets a minute, 720 sheets an hour, 5,760 for an 8-hour day. So our 27,720,000,000,000 sheets represent more than 4,800,000,000,000 days. With 235 working days in a year, a month's vacation for other monkey business, the chimp is either 20 billion years of age or we are 4,000,000,000 chimp generations later. But where'd you get the chimp and where'd you get the typewriter? And what about the complete title then, The Origin of Species? The chances there get into such astronomical difficulties it is simply impossible to contemplate. And yet, this kind of reasoning is oftentimes used on youngsters in high school level and college level classrooms about the idea of chance. Of what are the possibilities of there being all that we can see and know around us in these fantastic life forms, from the largest, the great whales and the elephants, down to the smallest, the tiny paramecium and the flagellates and so on that we looked at in a drop of water, the single-celled life forms that are all absolutely essential to the complex interdependency and the harmony and the survival of all life forms. And they speculate that monkeys might type books given enough time. Well, you write, for these brochures have already shown you about probability, what it says about evolution, and the one on the origin of life. They're absolutely free of charge if you write for them, or call, better yet, right now, before you do anything else, that toll-free number which you will see. We'll have this in the mail on its way to you right away. Check into it more thoroughly for yourself. Until next time, Garner Ted Armstrong. Goodbye, friends.
You have seen Garner Ted Armstrong. For literature offered on this program, send your request to Garner Ted Armstrong, Pasadena, California, 91123. Canadian viewers write Box 44, Vancouver, BC. Or in the continental United States, you may dial this toll-free number, 800-423-4444. That's 800-423-4444.